We're in the fifth parak of Avos, Mishnah Ches. Shiva devarim nemru begoylam v'shiva bechacham. We say seven things about a goylam, seven about a chacham. The parak is devoted to lists. Until now we're doing lists of tens. Now we move down to sevens. And we're contrasting a golem and a chacham. So the assumption is that golem in the Mishnah is the opposite of a chacham, someone who is not wise. Maybe it's a question of street smarts, as we'll see. What are the seven things we say about the golem and seven about the chacham? Chacham, eino medaber b'fnei mishu gadol mimenu b'chachma. A chacham will never speak in the presence of someone who's greater than him in chachma. Ve'eino nichnas l'toch divrei chaveru, nor will he interrupt someone else who's talking. Ve'eino nivhar l'hashiv, and he's not quick to respond without thinking first. Shoel ke'inyan, a meshav kahalacha, a chacham will ask on topic and will respond to the point. Ve'omer al rishon rishon v'achron achron, and he will respond or say things first, second, second. V'amashal lo shama, omer lo shamati. When he comes across something he'd never heard before, he says, I never heard. Umod ala emes, and he would admit to the truth. And the opposites apply to the goylem. So Rabbi Yehuda, in explaining this Mishnah, tells us that the chacham doesn't speak in front of one who's greater than him, b'chachma. He listens, he's quiet, he learns. He learns from the person who is speaking, who's greater than he is. The golem isn't really interested. He doesn't understand that he has what to gain by listening, so he will speak instead of listening. Eino nichnas l'toch divrei chaveru. The chacham allows his friend to say what he has to say till he concludes, and afterwards he will speak. That's a midah tova. And not like the golem, who will respond before he heard everything there is to hear. Eino nivhar l'hashiv, he doesn't answer quickly. He listens and he thinks about it, and he's mesunim b'din, so to speak. He takes his time, he's deliberate. So he doesn't say something that doesn't make sense, which is a thing that a chacham does, and a non-chacham doesn't do that. Shoel ke'inyan goes on to explain that he stays on topic, and meshav kahalocha, rishon rishon, achron achron. Usually we explain that to mean that if you're asked a number of questions, like Rivka Imenu, Rashi says, Yaakov Esther, not Yaakov Eliezer, who's basmiyat, does your father have a place for us to stay? And she first answered, bas basul anochi, yesh lana makam, there is place for you. So she answered, rishon rishon, achron achron. Ben Yonah says, it's more a matter of, if one thing depends on the other, then you start with the first step and lead to the second. The order is not relevant, but rather the construction of your response, that it should make sense in sequence. Amashal lo shama, omer lo shamati. If you didn't hear, you say, I didn't hear. That means to say, if you did not hear from your teachers, you'll say, I didn't hear from my teachers. If you have your own svara, you'll say, this is what I think pshat is. Marbeim is, I didn't hear from them. So I think this is what it is. So you're saying, lo shamati, I didn't hear this from my teachers. And I think this might be one of the explanations. And moed al ha'emes, even though you can argue your point, and maybe even win the argument, if you know that your point is flawed, you admit it. And the golem does the opposite. If we had to explain these concepts of the Mishnah and put it into a framework, would we have put it in the framework of a chacham and golem, or chacham and non-chacham? Isn't a lot of this simple derech eretz or etiquette? Common sense, this is how you should behave, these are midas tovos. And we're attributing it to a certain degree of chachma and non-chachma. So you could say, perhaps, that who is a chacham? A chacham is one who learns from all people. A chacham is one who has more developed midos and therefore conducts himself properly as opposed to the one who is not. The term golem, why is the Mishnah use the word golem? Rabbeinu Yonah says, a golem is kol davar she'ein tzuraso nigmeres. A golem is something which is not completely formed. Like the pasuk says in Tehillim, golem ro'o einecha. And we talk about kelim, golme kelim, unfinished pieces of wood that you're in the process of carving into something, and it's yet unfinished. So Ben Yonah says, the person who doesn't understand properly is called golem. He is not fully developed. And I think the point of this Mishnah in using the terms of golem versus chacham is trying to drive home perhaps a deeper point. We are put into this world and we are not perfect. And we spend our life trying to make ourselves better. The whole Bria really indicates this concept to us. The Ribbono Shel Olam creates wheat, and the Gemara says no one eats wheat. You have to grind it, and then you have to sift it, and you have to knead it, and then you make a dough and something you can finally end up eating. Or cotton grows, but sweaters don't. You have to take the cotton, and you have to spin it, and you have to make thread, and you have to weave, and then eventually you get clothing. The Ribbono Shel Olam provides us with raw materials, and then we have to develop them. And it's not only what we eat, it's not only what we wear. Even the Torah HaKadosha needs interpretation. There's a Torah Shebal Peh to explain the Torah Shebichsav. The Torah tells us that there's a concept of zavicha, a concept of slaughtering an animal. It doesn't go into the details of what shechita is all about and how to do shechita and what pasul shechita and what you need. You need Torah Shebal Peh for that. And many, many things like that. The Torah leaves a lot of things out that Torah Shebal Peh has to explain. In fact, you'll have a pasuk that says, Arbaim Yakenu, that someone who does a chet and deserves malchus, the pasuk says you hit him 40 times. And the Chacham say, no, you hit him 39 times. You don't hit him 40 times. It's 39 lashes. And it explains what the pasuk means when it says Arbaim. So the Torah is explained with Torah Shebal Peh. Without Torah Shebal Peh, the Torah is essentially a closed book. So it's another example where the Ribbono Shel Olam created with room for us to develop it and make it something that we can use. Well, people are no different. People are also imperfect. And we need to work on ourselves. So I think golem, you know, the word golem, we use it in a very negative expression. Someone's a golem, referring to someone perhaps who's brainless. But in the Mishnah's context, I think the more exact definition is golem is that which is undeveloped, unrefined. It needs some work. Needs working. The contrast in the Mishnah is the Chacham. So perhaps there would have been a better word to use. We would have thought something else as opposed to an unfinished product as the golem, but the finished product. The Mishnah used the term Chacham. Someone who has developed his intellect and in turn used that to develop his character traits to the point that we can identify the chacham, the person who's developed, the person who has perfected himself in seven places, seven areas. What are the seven things that we can determine his chachma, his development, his perfection? Recognizing that if someone is greater than him, he doesn't speak up. He's quiet when there's someone greater than him, and he's not going to speak up in front of someone who's gadol b'menu b'chachma. The person who's undeveloped doesn't realize that he should learn from this person, and rather than share his views, he should listen to what he has to say because he could grow from that. Eino nichnas letochtivrei chaveiro, not to interrupt the someone in the middle of speaking. Again, we may have said that's simple derech eretz, that's being polite, that's proper etiquette. It's development. Development. So in what case is development? That a person knows to have patience, to wait. You know, don't, he's in the middle of talking, let him say what he has to say. And then when you hear everything he has to say, it may resolve something. Sometimes you hear something, or automatically you hit with a question. If you just give another 2 minutes, the question will be resolved. Or sometimes we jump to conclusions and we don't understand what the person is saying. Sometimes, not even a question of learning or studying or whatever. In conversation, someone says something, and you may take great offense by what you just heard. If you give the person another minute, you'll realize you misunderstood what the person was saying. If you sometimes just jump all over him or her, and you don't realize that's not what they intended at all. Give them another minute or two to finish their thought, and you'll realize either they use the word differently than you use the word, or perhaps they mean something entirely different and you just totally missed the boat on what they were trying to say. So that happens with a certain degree of frequency. And if you just give them a chance, you would realize they meant nothing offensive at all. Einoniv halohashiv. A person who's developed doesn't respond immediately, which means you don't answer impulsively. You heard what they had to say, you heard them out, and you may feel like saying something which you may later regret, so you don't say it. You don't hurry to say. And sometimes, even if you heard everything they said, you may have still misunderstood them. You may not have gotten the whole story. And if you just hold back a little bit, you may be able to understand fully what they're trying to say and realize that they meant nothing offensive. So I told you the story, I think, that this teacher was applying to fly in the Challenger. I told you that story. She wanted to be the teacher to join the astronauts in the space shuttle. And day school, Jewish day school. And she wasn't accepted. But it was a whole class project and what she had to do and the preliminaries till she was rejected. And sometime later, when the tragedy occurred that the space shuttle blew up, a little boy comes to this teacher and says, "I wish you were on the Challenger." And the teacher is shocked. And had the teacher been Niv HaLohoshev, she would have said some very nasty things to this child and dragged him to the office and what else. She caught herself and just said to the child, "Why do you say that?" And the child said, "Because you're such a tzaddikus. If you would have been on the Challenger, it never would have blown up." So sometimes you have to just be patient. Don't go with your gut reaction to hear the whole thing. And this isn't just a story of a teacher and a little boy. This could be with a spouse, this could be with a friend, this could be with a relative. If you hear something that sounds very offensive for someone who you thought you have a good relationship with, you maybe misunderstood what they were trying to say. And give them the benefit of the doubt. Don't be Niv HaLohoshev. Don't be quick to jump on them, but give it a moment to perhaps clarify. Shoal ke'inin u'meshiv ka'halocha is again understanding how certain things fit into a pattern, and you ask what's appropriate in the right time and place. Sometimes some questions are appropriate, but you have to have the right place to ask or the right time to ask. And when you respond straight to the point. Don't give a whole run around. Al rishon, rishon, achron, achron. Again, it's a matter of just understanding what comes first, what comes second, and responding in kind. Amas shelo shama omer lo shamati mod ala emes. And the last two are to admit not being aware of something and admitting to the truth. These can be a challenge for some people. Perhaps we would have said the anav is the one who says Lo Shamati and Modala Emes, and the Balgaiva will never say Lo Shamati and will never say won't be Modala Emes. It's a question of arrogance and humility. But the Mishnah is describing Golem and Chacham. So the way we're saying it is the Golem is the person who's yet imperfect, the person who needs to work on himself. And one of the things that a person needs to work on is his ego and his arrogance. And the Chacham is the person who's better developed. And the Chacham will have better control of his ego and his arrogance. So we're not, again, putting it in the context of Anav versus Gaiva, but we're putting it in the context of developed and undeveloped, the way I understand the word Golem and Chacham. So if you're not familiar with something, you should be aware you're not familiar. You have to be open about it. You have to be willing to say Lo Shamati. And Moed Ala Emes, the Mefarshim point out that you find these traits by Moshe Rabbeinu, and it brings different episodes in the Chumash where this applies. There are people who unfortunately think it's beneath them to admit not knowing something. So they're not going to say Lo Shamati. There's nothing wrong with saying Lo Shamati. I don't know. This is beyond my expertise. It happens, you know, across the spectrum of people. And what the Mishnah is saying is it takes a certain degree of self-improvement, self-perfection, to be willing to say, I don't know. I never heard about it. I never learned this. Mod ala emes, some people have a hard time with that. You have a disagreement, and it's very difficult for some people to admit that they are wrong and that the argument that is being presented to them is correct. And they'll argue their point despite the fact that they know that their reasoning may be flawed. If a person has developed themselves properly, that will not present the problem to them. Now, these two things, Amash Lo Shama, Omar Lo Shamaiti, Moed Ala Emes, maybe are more difficult. And the question is, why is it so? Why is it that a person who has the proper Midas Tovos, and he doesn't interrupt, and he doesn't speak up in front of someone who's bigger than him, and he won't be impetuous in what he says, and he'll be deliberate and think carefully, and yet they're still caught up with not being Moed Ala Emes or not admitting Lo Shamati? So you could tell me perhaps Gaiva is more difficult to overcome than the other things, and it takes a higher development. Maybe the order of the Mishnah is indicative of the difficulty. Maybe that the first things in the Mishnah are easier to develop and the later things in the Mishnah are harder. Maybe Moed Ala Emes is the most difficult thing in the development. Perhaps, I don't know, I didn't say I don't say that. But maybe it's a possibility. Ultimately, you go back to probably the deeper analysis of why are some people arrogant and others not as? Or maybe a different way of putting it is, why are people, some people have a more difficult time with their arrogance than others? Everyone has to improve. Everyone has flaws. And no two people are the same. For some people, some things are more challenging than others. So that's a given. We accept that. For some people, certain midos tovos are easier to achieve, and some people it's harder to achieve. I think it's been said, and I think it's written about, and this is not necessarily based on Svarim, but just in general, I don't know, if you use the word psychology or whatever it is. People with poor self-esteem are generally going to be the ones who have a harder time with their gaiva. It sounds backwards, but it really, that's basically what happens. The person who has good self-esteem isn't cut down when he has to say, I don't know, or you're right, I was wrong. If you have good self-esteem, you're fine with yourself. You're fine with who you are. You don't feel any less of who you are or your abilities or anything else by admitting to a mistake. Someone with poor self-esteem, to admit a mistake is crushing. To be moed al ha'ames, to say they were wrong, could be almost an impossibility. So it's kind of, you know, a reverse in how this works. Those who have poor self-esteem are going to have a much greater challenge with this. So again, one could say that in the deeper, bigger picture of things, the goylam is the one who has not developed his self-esteem properly. If a person has an undeveloped self-esteem, then they are going to be more prone to the midos of the goylam that the Mishnah describes. And the problem is, there's been a lot of experimentation that doesn't always work out well in how do you develop good self-esteem. When I say experimentation, I mean that there was a period when there were those who said that when you teach children, the way to build their self-esteem is to give everyone good grades on everything, to make sure everyone is the winner of their games, and make sure that everyone gets awards at the end of the year. You come up with awards for everybody, and make sure that everyone feels good about themselves. So you're just going to make sure that they all have these positive experiences. The problem is, they finally found out years later that it didn't help. The self-esteem did not grow in the children who are constantly being rewarded and awarded and recognized and noticed for things they didn't deserve. And I think what has been borne out is that when children are rewarded and recognized when they put an effort to something, that's what builds self-esteem. When they work on something and they achieve something and they're recognized for their accomplishments, when they put in the effort, that will build self-esteem. But if they didn't put in the effort, then you're just going to say, oh, wow, you did such a great job, and give them a certificate. It didn't do anything for them. I think they did this even in colleges. They did these kinds of things in certain college courses and to see how it affected, what happened afterwards. And I believe what they discovered is that you're not going to build self-esteem for just unforgiving rewards that were not deserved, that didn't build up the children or adults in these situations. So if a person wants to work on developing their self-esteem, what you have to do is, obviously I don't know if a person does it themselves, it has to do with their interactions, but when dealing with people and dealing with children specifically, rewarding their efforts and their accomplishments is something they feel good about. If a person works on something and then there's an accomplishment that comes with it and they feel good about their accomplishment, that's where you can build self-esteem. But just to reward them for not anything they deserve at all, they thought it would help their self-esteem, but in the end it didn't. I think what happens, they're giving good grades. Like one course, they're giving good grades to all the kids, regardless of how they did. Don't worry about how they much work they put into it. Give them good grades, that'll build their self-esteem, because they have good grades. And it didn't work. Giving good grades did not work to build the self-esteem. What worked was when they did a paper and they did good on it, that built self-esteem. But just to give them a good grade without the work, the grades alone meant nothing, because I guess the kids see right through it. It didn't mean anything to them. So there's a certain degree of, you have to put in the effort to get the rewards, and then if you do that, you can build it up. So the person who has a healthy self-esteem doesn't feel that it hurts him, so to speak, to admit not knowing and to admit being wrong. and the person with the less self-esteem has a very hard time with it. So getting back to a normal situation when you have two people who get along, they like each other, it could be friends, relatives, husband, wife, they still have a problem with my dilemmas. Why is it that there's still going to be a problem of admitting that they're wrong? So, does everyone have poor self-esteem? I don't know. I don't think it's that. Even if you have people with good self-esteem, so if you have good self-esteem, it should be easier to say I was wrong, because it doesn't mean I'm less of a person for being wrong. So why do people have a hard time with it?
Shows their inner golem.
Their inner golem. Is he saying? Yeah. We're not perfect. We're not perfect. The bottom line is we have work to do. We have to work on ourselves. There were times that before I moved here, I would counsel Chassanim. I would counsel Chassanim on a pretty regular basis before I came here. And I always told them that if you ever get into a disagreement with your wife, you have to admit that you were wrong. It makes no difference if you're wrong or not. It's irrelevant. You have to admit you were wrong. The reason I say that, I told them, is because if you admit that you're wrong, if you were right, it's easier for your spouse to say that they were wrong. If you don't admit you're wrong, you're gonna knock heads. I'm right. She's right. Each one says they're right. The goal isn't to be right. The goal is to live happily together, to work together. I once saw an article, and it basically was saying that little children are much better at this than adults, of not worrying about who's right and wrong, let's just get along. So when you stand on principle, who's right and who's wrong, that will interfere with working together with somebody. So what's important in life? What's important is to be right, or it's important to get along with people? So good, so I'm not right. Why is it so important to be right? What's important is that you should get along. You should care about each other. You should do for each other. Being right or wrong is not that important. It's not. Now, I'm not saying if there's a significant issue that has to be discussed among a husband and wife, which school to send their children to could be a significant issue. Take a new job, leave an old job for a new job, move from one city to another city. These are significant issues. And there can be disagreements of what's the right thing to do. Even then, it's not like there's an absolute right and wrong. Each one has a feeling, right, this is a better thing to do or not, and if they can't resolve it, they should sit with a third party who's perhaps objective and non-involved, who's better equipped to discuss the issue and weigh the pros and cons for them. And there's a value in going to someone who's not caught up and is not negei b'davar. So there are significant decisions that people have to make in their lives that they may not agree upon what is the best thing to do. And sometimes you turn to a third party and say, can you help us resolve what is the best thing in given this situation? It's a fascinating thing that when you're not involved in a disagreement, you can understand that everyone has their own bias. You have your own deep-rooted reasons why you maybe feel one way or the other, and you don't necessarily realize. I was discussing with a couple an issue of relocating, and one of them wanted to relocate and one wanted to stay. And in the end, it came out that the relocation had nothing to do with relocating. The person was unhappy, period. They were unhappy about whatever it is, and they needed to work on themselves or see someone, because no matter where they go, they're still going to be unhappy. The underlying cause for leaving was not what appeared on the table. There was something beneath the surface. And ultimately I said, your reasons to leave, that's not the reasons. Deep down, you're not happy here, and what will make you happy there? If it's because you're not happy, then you have to work on what the issue is and how to resolve that. So sometimes no one sees that because you're caught up in it. In any event, in a relationship, being right is not so important. Why is it important to be right? What's important is that you should get along with each other, and you should work together, and you should care for each other. These are important things. Right, how important is it to be right? So again, I think children who play are less concerned with who's right and who's wrong, as long as they have some fun with this person they're playing with. When you get older, you have a harder time with it, because that's wrong. We get stuck on that. It's like on principle. And you have to sometimes consider, why is that important? And that's why I would tell Chasanim, you could admit that you were wrong. It's in the big scheme of things, it won't make any difference. And I guarantee you, a week from now, it won't make a difference either. A week later, maybe a day or two, it won't make a difference either. Just in the moment, you get caught up, and you have this disagreement. Then I always tell them, every couple is going to have a disagreement. It's not like you'll never have a disagreement in your marriage. You're going to have disagreements. The question, what do you do when you disagree? And if it's a question of right and wrong, I would tell them, just admit you're wrong. Just admit you're wrong. You have nothing to lose. And I did find this in a sefer. I wasn't just making it up. I did find it in a sefer, the whole explanation behind it. But I said, it's pashut. If you admit that you're wrong, so then odds are, if you were really wrong, then of course you should admit you're wrong. And if you're not wrong, and you say you were wrong, odds are when things calm down, your spouse will realize and be able to say on their own that they're sorry that they are wrong, which is common, not always. Depends on how much your inner goylem has been corrected. But the point is, I think this is another nekuda, being moed al emes. So you want to admit the truth when you're wrong. You should accept it, that you're wrong. So I would go the next step. You should be moed even if it makes no difference if it's emes or not. You should accept the other person with their position. Again, I'm not talking about being a pushover, and I'm not saying that in important life decisions that you're not going to have a meaningful discussion, and if you can't come to a reasonable conclusion, that you won't seek guidance from someone that you mutually respect to give you some help. But the bottom line is, admitting that you're wrong, what's so terrible going to happen when you admit you're wrong? Like, I'm not saying anyone in this room should do that. Let your husband do that. But I'm just saying, I would just say, what is lost by admitting that? Does it mean that you're a bad person? Does it mean that you're unintelligent? What does it mean? It doesn't mean anything. It's almost as if to say, you think you're so perfect that you can't be wrong, that now all of a sudden, now you're not perfect. And until now, I was 100% perfect. And this is my one flaw, to admit that I'm wrong, is a chink in the whole thing, that now I'm not perfect anymore. It's ridiculous. None of us are perfect. We're not perfect. So if I'm wrong in this disagreement, all of a sudden, what? Nothing. Nothing. It's almost like you start wondering about, you learn Parshas Korach, and you learn about Machlekes, and how terrible Machlekes is, and how destructive Machlekes is. And like what? So when it gets to a machlokas like that, what's really horrible is everyone's machlokas is Hashem Shemayim. In other words, they're not stop having machlokas. To admit that I'm wrong in such a machlokas is apikorsis, it's kfira. Right? All of a sudden, it takes on a whole new dimension. The Yetzer Hara convinces you that it's the biggest mitzvah in the world to have this machlokas. And that's, again, one of the Yetzers of the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara convinces you that this is a mitzvah. You can't admit you're wrong in this. To admit you're wrong in this is a chil Hashem. It's a chil Hashem to admit you're wrong. How can you admit you're wrong? That's you know, how once upon a time, Bali Machlekes really got into the Machlekes. They really got entrenched in their disagreements because they maintained this is Hashem Shemayim. This is the thing to do. So they say over Maisa, where there were three brothers that inherited a Yerusha and got into a terrible machlekes about the Yerusha. Unfortunately, One of the great sources of disagreement in families that breaks families apart is inheritance. If the Yerusha is not thought of carefully by those who, when they're still alive, it could lead to great discord afterwards. And we all know this from terrible machlokes in Hasidic courts, who's the next Rebbe, if it wasn't clear from the previous Rebbe. You have these terrible disagreements between brothers, between cousins. We all know these things happen, and that's just a dramatic example, and it can happen in families too. So there was a case of three very fine Erlecha B'nai Torah who got into this terrible disagreement after the parent died, involving the Yerusha. So, if I remember correctly, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach went to sit down with one of the sons, heard his tainas, and he said, "You're 100% right. Your tainas are 100% right. But I think for the sake of Shalom, it makes sense that you should work out a compromise and maybe do this." I said, "Yeah, that sounds reasonable." He goes to the second brother, listens to his arguments. "You're 100% right. Your arguments are solid. You're zichur right. But you know, l'man ha-shalom, maybe it's kedai to do a pshara, do a compromise." And he was agreeable to that. He went through the exact same thing. As long as each one heard that they were right, they were fine. They were willing to compromise. Until someone said, if they were one saying, "I'm wrong, I'm not wrong." And then they would go on and argue, ripping the family apart. When the Shlomo Zalman, who was the God of Yisrael, would tell each one, "You're 100% right," they were willing to compromise. "I'm not problem compromising. As long as I'm right, that's fine. I'll compromise." So, you know, people have in their head, they have to be right. And if they're not right, again, so it becomes a matter of Yadus, Kavod Ha'av, this is the Kavod for my parent, how can I, you know, admit that I'm wrong? And it becomes a religious machlokas, and those are the worst. Yetzer Hara convinces you that you're doing a mitzvah to argue. That's one of the atzas of Yetzer. There's no mitzvah to argue. Is there ever a time when a Gadol B'Yisrael will say this position that's being forward by whatever is wrong? Yeah, there is. There will be times when you could say that there's going to be a mandate for a disagreement when someone or an organization or an institution does something which violates halacha, and the Gadolim say not to endorse that or not to sponsor that or not to be a member of, because I'm sure the other side has their own rabbis who tell them it's fine. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they just reject. You know, it depends on what the situation is. There comes a point you have to follow your Torah leadership. But those are like the exceptional cases. That's not your friends. That's not your husband. That's not your sister. These are exceptional, unique cases. We're over the years, there have been things like that. And it doesn't mean it's a mitzvah to be involved in machlokes either. It just means if you're going to listen to your God, he says this is what you should do. He says, what are you going to do? He's not telling you to protest. He's not telling you to scream at people. He's just telling you don't pay membership dues to this place, or don't whatever it is. Don't be affiliated with a certain group, so you won't. But it doesn't mean you have to be an active Baal Machlokas. But the idea of the Machlokas, or the idea of not the problem of Moed Ala Emes, that's where I see it could be the most difficult issue when you're dealing with big Torah issues and Gedol Yisrael are involved and questions of Yahadus and Kefira. So whether it's the Yetzer Hara's manifestation or it's a legitimate issue, so I can't say, you know, whatever the case may be. But in the regular day-to-day issues that come up in our lives, you have to think about it. Why is it so important to be right? It's not so important to be right. It's important to be friends. It's important to get along. Being right is not so important. What is it again? And again, it goes back to self-esteem and all the other things we mentioned before. So the golem, the person who's undeveloped, is going to be more challenged with these things. The Chacham, who we're saying is one who's more developed, understands that's not important. It's just not important. For most things, they're not even worth arguing over. Like, why are we even having a discussion about this? So good. So you're right. Fine. Like, what is that? Most things are not even okay to have an argument about. Anyway, most things people argument are not argument worthy. And the things that are argument worthy, ultimately the goal is to work together, not to win an argument. The goal isn't to win the argument. The goal is to come to an agreement that we can work together. And if it's something that you can't figure out how to work together, then you're going to have to ask someone to help you work this through to know what's. And sometimes it's not clear cut. Sometimes someone who's objective can look at it and say, you're missing something, or you are negeh b'davar, so your bias is leading you in a way. Sometimes you'll be told, both sides have value, decide for yourselves. I can't tell you what to do. They're both legitimate, both acceptable. You make a decision. But the bottom line is, Moedala Emes, it's a very high level of perfection, but we really should think about that it shouldn't be such a big deal. It should not be such a big deal. We shouldn't think that because we were mistaken or we were wrong or we didn't know this, that all of a sudden means that I am inferior, that I am less, that I'm not valuable, that I'm anything. Again, it's all this working on yourself and understanding who you are, our place in the world and our relationship with the Kaddish Baruch Hu, and understanding that these things ultimately are not worthy of making an issue out of. So that's how we work on perfecting ourselves. That's how we work on becoming Chacham, that we are okay with saying, I didn't know, and we are okay with saying, I was wrong.